Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the Ukraine military clashes with separatist convoy, Thailand's army chief takes over, and the country's new prime minister. U.S. lawmakers urge President Obama to expand military action against the Islamic State. And Northern California cleans up from a major but not deadly earthquake. It's all ahead. I'm Terry Wing. Ukraine says government forces battled today with a convoy of separatist armored vehicles near the Russian border. Military sources say the convoy was stopped as it was advancing near a town on the Azov Sea. The French news agency quotes a Ukrainian official as saying the convoy entered the country from Russia, but that report has not been confirmed. Meanwhile, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Monday that Moscow wants to send another humanitarian aid convoy to eastern Ukraine. Lavrov says Russia sent an official note to Kiev on Sunday with information about the new aid convoy, including information about the type of aid that will be delivered. Russia has faced extreme criticism from Kiev and the West for its recent aid convoy to the rebel-held Ukrainian city of Luhansk. Ukraine and its allies had expressed fears Russia could use the aid to smuggle arms to pro-Russian separatists inside Ukraine or use the convoy as a prelude to a full-scale military operation. Sunday was Independence Day in Ukraine, 23 years since independence from Russia, and it took on a special meaning in Slovyansk, a town that earlier this year was under the control of pro-Russian separatists. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports on a new nationalist fever sweeping the city as residents there fight for a more Ukrainian-type future.
Democracy is in action at City Hall in Slovyansk, Donetsk province. Citizens here are confronting the chairman of a local machinery plant, Pavel Pridvorov, who was vying for the position as acting mayor. Angry residents accuse him of supporting the pro-Russian separatists that took control of the town in April and were ousted by Ukrainian forces last month. Valentina, a local businesswoman, takes the floor to condemn the current city council.
The executive authority didn't do anything. Moreover, when everything happened, they all unanimously and quietly supported it. I think the old staff has no moral right.
Tired and angry after months of fighting, citizens are demanding a change in the city's formerly pro-Russian leadership. The harshest comments are directed at Pridvorov himself, accused by this woman of supplying separatist forces with material from his machine plant. Pridvorov does his best to defend himself.
We never gave any equipment willingly. I will say it again, we didn't give any equipment willingly, only under the barrel of the gun.
It is a festive atmosphere in Slovyansk as Ukrainians here mark 23 years since the country became independent from the Soviet Union. This year, citizens are reevaluating their country's future, embracing a newfound Ukrainian nationalism that has risen up in resistance to the separatist movement. Ina is a Slovyansk resident and a mother of two.
I'm so glad that we have peace and that we are liberated. Ukraine is a great country and we've survived. But now I think everything will be different. A new history will start. Glory to Ukraine.
Slava Ukraini.
The city still bears the marks of the heavy fighting that took place here. Meantime, battles between rebels and Ukrainian forces continue in the nearby cities of Donetsk and Luhansk. Ukraine and its allies accuse Russia of supplying the separatists, though Moscow denies any involvement. Volunteer soldiers who helped free the city now patrol the streets of Slovyansk to make sure separatists do not return. Their deputy commander, Yuri Chiban, is confident that an overall victory is in sight.
They came as volunteers. They understand they have to defend our country, the integrity of our country, no matter who invades or who wants to oppose us. We will win.
But despite the optimism, Ukraine still has a long way to go to win the battle in the east, which some are starting to see as part of a prolonged fight for independence. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Slovyansk, Ukraine.
In Thailand, the army general who led the May 22nd coup has now officially assumed the post as the kingdom's prime minister. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from Bangkok on today's ceremony.
Thailand's army chief bowed before a large photograph of King Bhumibol Adunadet just after the reading of a palace decree naming him the kingdom's 29th prime minister. The acting secretary general of the National Legislative Assembly, Norodom Phimsen, proclaimed the royal assent, stating, "His Majesty the King has endorsed General Prayut Chan-o-cha as prime minister to govern the country from this day forward." The general, over a span of 3 months, has imposed martial law, deposed the civilian government, and appointed a legislature filled with military officers that unanimously selected him to become prime minister. General Prayut, immediately following Monday's brief ceremony at Army headquarters, vowed to submit his selections for his cabinet in October for royal approval. General Prayut, still dressed in his formal white army uniform, speaking for the first time as prime minister, says Thailand is confronted by many problems. He notes these need to be solved ahead of the realization next year of the ASEAN Economic Community, in which Thailand, as the region's second largest economy, is expected to play a leading role. The 60-year-old general, who is due to retire from the army next month, is the first coup leader to serve as prime minister since 1957. General Prayut was also a key figure in the coup in 2006 that ousted then Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat, the billionaire telecommunications tycoon whose political parties have won every national election for more than a decade. His younger sister, Yingluck Shinawat, was forced from office shortly before this year's coup after an extended period of political turmoil. Officials of the junta, known as the National Council for Peace and Order, say General Prayut wants to permanently eradicate the influence of the Shinawat clan. Thailand has been polarized between the mainly urban royalist elite and middle class, who are strongly opposed to the Shinawats, and their main backers, who are mostly the rural poor. With Thailand still under martial law, giving authorities broad powers to round up dissenters for interrogation, opposition to the junta has been effectively squelched inside the country. Thai critics abroad, most of whom are now considered fugitives by the military government, have condemned General Prayut's actions as an illegal power grab. The coup has also been criticized by Western governments, which are urging a quick return to democracy. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Chinese police in Macau detained five people today involved in organizing an unofficial referendum this week that's aimed at measuring public support for direct election of the city's next leader. The chief executive is currently selected by a 400-member official committee. The referendum comes 2 months after a similar unofficial vote, also opposed by Beijing, was held in nearby Hong Kong. Macau and Hong Kong are two special administrative regions of the People's Republic of China. The Hong Kong organizers say nearly 800,000 people cast ballots, mostly online, demanding they be allowed to select the next chief executive, the territory's top leader, who is to be elected in 2017. Hong Kong's basic law stipulates all candidates must be approved by a nominating committee. Today, in an op-ed article, the state-run China Daily said the basic law remains the fundamental legal basis for electing the chief executive. Saturday, the Global Times said political reform will be implemented under the basic law and there will be no compromise. The Macau Election Committee is expected to make its decision on the chief executive's five-year term Sunday. Fernando Chu has been chief executive since 2009. One of those detained today is Jason Chow, president of the Open Macau Society, one of three groups organizing the poll in the former Portuguese colony. He spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty while sitting in the prosecutor's office waiting to find out his fate. Chow says that the voting, which began Sunday, has gone well. He says people were told to vote online or in person.
Unfortunately, we were unable to run the polling stations yesterday because the police cracked down on our activities on the street. And now I'm in the prosecution office and I'm being charged of a crime of aggravated disobedience because I ignored the order from the government for permanently deleting the citizens' data. But I insist that my processing or my collection of personal data from the citizens is lawful, because I have obtained the citizens' consent prior to processing their data. And after verifying the results of the referendum, the personal data will be permanently deleted. But in our case, the government is using whatever means possible to suppress our civil referendum.
How is the referendum going? Is it getting a lot of support?
We have attracted about 5,000 voters. It means that our civil referendum has been more representative than the real chief executive election.
Were you inspired by what happened in Hong Kong?
I was inspired by the parallel election that took place in Hong Kong 2 years ago in 2012. Back then, the University of Hong Kong's public opinion program organized a parallel election or mock referendum for the chief executive election. And but in our civil referendum, we put forth two motions. First, should the chief executive be elected by universal suffrage in 2019? And the second motion is, do you have confidence in the third candidate, Choi Sai-ong, becoming the chief executive?
What's going to happen to you personally?
I was arrested yesterday for having violated the personal data protection law, and I was apprehended like I was a drug dealer. I was surrounded by more than 10 police officers after a visit to the toilets. They wanted to arrest me out of the sight of media.
Is this poll going to go forward, and what are you going to do once you get the results?
We will announce the result, yes, although we cannot set up physical polling stations on the streets, but the online voting is still going on. And the result for the first motion will be announced on the 31st of August, which is the official chief executive election day. And the result of the second motion will be announced on the 2nd of September.
And what are you hoping to do with the results?
The result is one thing. The result will show the public opinions towards the chief executive election system and the candidates. And the second important purpose, which I think is quite important, is the chance for the citizens to experience the exercise of civil rights.
Charles says that he hopes to gather at least 10,000 votes out of a population of 600,000 by the time of the unofficial referendum ends August 31st. Macau, the only place in China where casinos are legal, reverted to Chinese rule in 1999 and has experienced a decade of fast economic growth. However, some residents have become concerned over perceived inequalities, including inflated housing prices. More than 20,000 took the streets to protest in May. Al-Qaeda-linked militants in Syria have freed an American journalist held captive for 2 years, just days after another Islamic group beheaded U.S. reporter James Foley. Kidnappers turned over Peter Theo Curtis to United Nations peacekeepers in the Golan Heights Sunday, and then they handed him over to U.S. officials. Qatar helped arrange Curtis's freedom. The exact conditions of his release are unclear. A White House spokesman says President Barack Obama shares in the joy and relief of Curtis's freedom and will keep using all tools possible to win freedom for the remaining hostages in Syria. Curtis, who also writes under the name of Theo Padnos, is from Boston and has written books for American magazines. The al-Qaeda-affiliated group Nusra Front kidnapped him in Syria in 2012. The group is one of a number of Islamic rebel groups fighting to overthrow the Syrian government. Curtis's release, as we said, comes just days after the ultra-militant Islamic State decapitated U.S. journalist James Foley and then posted the gruesome murder on the Internet. Britain said it's close now to identifying Foley's killer, who spoke with an English accent. The Sunday Times newspaper reports British intelligence agencies have identified him, but sources did not divulge his name. Islamic State threatens to kill another U.S. reporter, Stephen Sotloff, if President Obama does not end U.S. airstrikes in Iraq. Meantime, several congressional leaders are calling for expanded U.S. airstrikes against Islamic State targets, saying the murder of Foley marks a turning point in assessing the threat posed by the militant network. VOA congressional correspondent Cindy Sain reports from Washington about the increasing pressure on President Barack Obama to consider strikes in Syria as well as Iraq.
The U.S. Congress is in recess, and members are scattered across the country in their home districts. But a number of congressional leaders appeared on Sunday talk shows to voice alarm about the threat posed by the Islamic State group in the wake of the brutal murder of American journalist James Foley. The Republican chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, Michael McCaul, told ABC News this week that Islamic State, also known as ISIS, presents the greatest threat the world has seen since the September 11th terrorist attacks of 2001.
This has been festering for the last year, and now it's culminating with the killing and beheading of an American journalist, which I think is a turning point. The American people, it has sort of opened their eyes to what ISIS really is.
The Republican chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Mike Rogers, agrees. Rogers told NBC's Meet the Press that one of the problems is some fighters from Europe and the United States have gone to the Middle East to join the terrorist network, and they could easily travel back to the West.
They are one plane ticket away from U.S. shores, and that's why we're so concerned about it.
Retired U.S. Marine General John Allen agrees on the seriousness of the threat and said the United States needs to take a regional approach working with its allies.
It's going to require a comprehensive approach. It's got to be more than simple pinpoint attacks on key ISIS locations that are just security locations in and around dams.
President Obama has tried to limit the new military campaign in Iraq to protecting civilians under dire threat and American diplomats. But he has also said the U.S. will be relentless and do whatever it takes to protect U.S. citizens. Members of Congress have reacted with strong emotions to the execution of James Foley, but some have cautioned that the U.S. should not be provoked into sending combat troops back into Iraq. Democratic Congresswoman Donna Edwards said Congress needs to debate any military escalation when members return in September.
But we need to have a debate. I think that's really important. I don't think the president can continue beyond the war powers authorization without an authorization from Congress.
Analysts say President Obama will likely weigh the consequences of expanding U.S. military action against the extremist group in the coming days. Cindy Sain, VOA News, Washington.
Palestinian officials say Israeli attacks early today killed two people in the Gaza Strip as the conflict between the warring sides continued for a 49th day. The Israeli military said it carried out 16 airstrikes today, including targeting two mosques in Gaza. The fighting that erupted on July 8th has killed more than 2,100 Palestinians, most of them civilians, including close to 500 children. 64 Israeli soldiers and 4 civilians have been killed. The latest airstrikes come a day after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told Israelis to be prepared for the conflict to stretch into September and warned residents in Gaza to leave sites where Hamas militants are operating. Libya's Islamist militants are opening challenging now the legitimacy of the country's elected parliament after its fighters took control of Tripoli's battered international airport. After seizing the airport in the Libyan capital, the militia from the coastal city of Misrata called for the old General National Congress to be reinstated. It alleged the parliament elected in June was complicit in mysterious airstrikes on Misrata positions at the airport as its militiamen fought rival fighters from the mountainous region of Zintan for 6 weeks for control of the key facility. The Misratis directly blamed the airstrikes in the past week on Egypt and the United Arab Emirates. Cairo denied its involvement, but the UAE had no immediate comment. Coming up, residents in Northern California are shaken and stirred by an overnight earthquake.
Each week on Daybreak Asia, we cover the stories of women who are working to change the world. she was locked up by her family when she reached puberty, which happens to all the Muslim girls in her village. And she then went on to become a politician and an activist, and she's an all-round amazing person, really.
I'm Frances Alonso, producer of Women Rising. Listen for my reports about the empowerment of women around the world on Daybreak Asia and on the web at voanews.com.
Authorities are coordinating extensive cleanup efforts following the strongest earthquake to hit the northern part of the U.S. state of California in 25 years. A 6.0 magnitude quake shook the region early Sunday, injuring more than 100 people, causing major damage to buildings, igniting fires, and knocking out power to thousands. Some of the damaged structures were historic buildings. Bricks, debris, and crushed cars litter the streets, and power, water, and gas lines have been cut. The quake was centered between San Francisco and Sacramento. Most of the damage was around the town of Napa in Northern California's picturesque winemaking region. These two people are residents of Napa.
I sleep on a loft bed, so I was probably 6 feet up. Two of my friends were in the front room sleeping, and I mean, it felt like the house got bombed pretty much. Went on for probably 45 seconds or so, I don't know. And I mean, it was lucky that the bed didn't break and then more things didn't come down, but yeah, the whole house is completely cracked open, exposed to the outside, every door frame, the inside of my closet. It came 4 feet off of the foundation. I mean, the house is gonna need to be torn down. It's done.
I just knew instantaneously it was an earthquake, and it shook back and forth. It just rocked you really violently for about 30 seconds, and I heard things in my home crashing. And then got up, and everything in your house is in disarray. Things are broken, and no electricity, of course. So you're walking around with your cell phone flashlight looking for your flashlight, but it's the worst.
Robert Graves of the U.S. Geological Survey spoke with reporters about the quake, saying California sits along a series of seismic faults.
We haven't determined a specific fault at this point. It's in between two major systems, the Hayward-Rogers Creek system and the Concord-Green Valley system. Like Southern California, there are a number of secondary faults up there as well. The last earthquake in this area was in the year 2000, magnitude 4.9. Historically, there was an earthquake in the 1800s, magnitude 6.4. In that same region.
Experts have warned of dozens of aftershocks in the coming days. California Governor Jerry Brown has declared a state of emergency in parts of Northern California. Meantime, a 6.9 magnitude earthquake has hit a sparsely populated area of southern Peru. The U.S. Geological Survey says the quake struck late Sunday, 42 kilometers east-northeast of the town of Tambo, and about 467 kilometers southeast of the capital, Lima, where residents felt slight shaking. Peru's Civil Defense Institute said that there were no immediate reports of injuries or serious damage. French President François Hollande has dissolved the French government. Prime Minister Manuel Valls offered up the resignation of his socialist government today, and Mr. Hollande accepted, ordering the prime minister to form a new government by Tuesday. The political move follows Economy Minister Arnaud Montebert's recent criticism of the country's economic policies and his questioning of allied Germany's budgetary actions. France is under pressure from the EU to get its finances in order, but Montebert has questioned whether the austerity pressed by the EU will actually benefit France. Thousands of people are expected to attend funeral services today in the central U.S. city of St. Louis for Michael Brown, the unarmed black teenager who was shot and killed by a white police officer earlier this month. 18-year-old Brown was fatally shot by Officer Darren Wilson in a confrontation on August 9th in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson. Monday's funeral will be under heavy police surveillance to guard against renewed violence. Ferguson has been mostly calm in recent days following nearly 2 weeks of unrest. And acclaimed British actor and Oscar-winning director Richard Attenborough has died. He was 90 years old. Among his most famous works was the 1982 Indian epic Gandhi, which went on to win 8 Oscars, including Best Film, Best Actor for Ben Kingsley, and Best Director for himself. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can always get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Terry Wing in Washington.
This is Today in History. On August 25th in the year 325 AD, the Council of Nicaea ended, concluding debate on the deity of Christ. The council issued the Nicene Creed, the most widely accepted doctrinal statement in Christianity. Back in 1609, Galileo Galilei demonstrated his telescope to Venetian lawmakers. Galileo improved the optical capabilities of telescopes and was one of the first to use it to observe the moon and planets. In 1768, James Cook began his first voyage. Cook made the first recorded European contact with the eastern coastline of Australia and the Hawaiian Islands, and the first recorded circumnavigation of New Zealand. In 1835, the New York Sun newspaper spread false stories about the discovery of life on the moon in what became known as the Great Moon Hoax. The paper claimed that a huge telescope had spotted bat-like humans and other forms of life on the moon. The Sun never explained or retracted the fantastic stories. In 1912, the Kuomintang, the Chinese Nationalist Party, was founded. In 1914, the library of the Catholic University at Leuven, Belgium, was deliberately destroyed by the German army. Hundreds of thousands of irreplaceable books and Gothic and Renaissance manuscripts were lost. In 1944, during World War II, Paris was liberated from the Germans by the Allies. In 1948, the U.S. House Un-American Activities Committee held its first ever televised congressional hearing, a confrontation between former communist Whitaker Chambers and accused Soviet spy Alger Hiss. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Rape is often used as a tactic of war, intentionally terrorizing and brutalizing entire communities. And although women and girls are by far the most common victims, men and boys are also frequently assaulted. Given that the legacy of sexual violence and conflict can cause long-term instability, addressing impunity is part of the process for restoring peace. The scourge of sexual violence and conflict has been identified by the United Nations as a matter of acute and urgent concern, said U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Samantha Power. Neither the fog of war nor the associated breakdown of law provide any explanation or excuse for actions that violate the rights and disrespect the fundamental dignity of human beings. Working through the United Nations Security Council, the international community has repeatedly stated that sexual violence will not be tolerated. But much more needs to be done if we are to stamp out such criminal behavior. Where sexual violence occurs because the government is weak, the international community must do more to help local institutions develop responses, including access to justice and support for survivors. That's because governments have a duty to protect and promote the rights of citizens. Every government should have or establish laws, develop institutions, and pursue policies that protect from sexual violence all of its people, regardless of gender, social, or economic status. It is very important that every government take steps to ensure that the stigma of sexual violence no longer bedevils the survivors, including male survivors, as is too often the case. Instead, it is time to affirm that guilt and stigma fall on the shoulders of the perpetrators. In far too many countries, the victims of sexual violence still have little, if any, effective legal recourse. Until that changes, predators will not be deterred, survivors will hesitate to come forward, and justice will remain beyond reach, said Ambassador Power. Sexual abuse is inflicted out of cruelty and robs people of the right to life, liberty, and security of person. Still, for far too long, it has been treated as part of the spoils of victory. That must end. The government and the people of the United States strongly support a concerted strategy across the globe to address this scourge, both in peace and war.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.